It is now 8:07 here at WCCO. Welcome back to Steele Talkin'. I'm your host, Geralyn Steele. It is what I love to do, is sit here with you on a Sunday night. So thank you for joining us. I'm excited about this next guest because earlier this month, the U.S. Treasury released a report stating that the nation's debt had surpassed $31 trillion for the first time. $31 trillion. Wow. Many are asking, how did we get to this point? What are the biggest factors in the debt getting this high, and so much more? But we're going to find out and get the answers to those questions by asking Mark Goldwine. He is the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He joins us now on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
May I call you Mark?
Mark is fine.
All right. Thank you. Okay. First of all, I did not realize, you know, when I first thought about it, I went, well, you know, we have so many trillions of dollars. And I looked it up for 2022, and it looks like we are broke because we are not at 31 trillion today. Am I correct?
So there's a few ways to measure debt, but we're either at 25 trillion or 31 trillion. Either way, it's a lot of dollars. It's a record not only in dollars, but even as a share of the economy. It's higher than any time except for 1 year after World War II.
Okay. So the question for me, the big question, is we are here at $31 trillion. How bad is that?
The economy is not going to melt down from debt being at $31 trillion. But it's in serious danger if our debt continues to rise rapidly as opposed to us at least slowing the growth. It's in danger of persistent bouts of high inflation like we're having now. It's in danger of slower economic growth. And it's in some danger, small but not zero, of a financial crisis caused by just an overwhelming amount of debt.
Right. You know, the Associated Press wrote that we are edging closer to the statutory ceiling of roughly $31.4 trillion. What do they mean by statutory ceiling?
Yeah, so there's a cap called the debt limit that basically says you cannot borrow above a certain amount. But every time we hit that cap, we raise it.
Right.
And there's things we can do to sort of game it, but probably we're going to hit that cap maybe next fall. And politicians need to either raise it or we default.
So what got us here?
It's no one thing, basically we've had 20 years of fiscal irresponsibility, 22 years of fiscal responsibility across parties, where we keep cutting taxes, we keep increasing spending, we don't pay for most things, and we've ignored the largest cost drivers that are already built into the budget, and that's especially the Medicare program and the Social Security program, both of which, by the way, are headed towards insolvency in their own right.
So how long has it been? Well, it hasn't been that long at all. I know that. I really should ask, the money we have given, our government has given to the wealthy over the years. We're talking $2 trillion, I believe, was the last one I heard about, read about. And if we keep giving it to the wealthy and it's not going to those who really need it, the tax cut, and then you give them more money so that they can keep giving and putting in and investing in our country. But I don't understand why they get to get the big numbers and then the rest of us, especially the middle class who pays all of the bills, basically, of this country, why wouldn't they also offer that kind of money to the middle class?
Yeah, so in 2017, we did pass a $2 trillion tax cut that we didn't pay for it. It did include middle class as well, tax cuts as well as tax cuts for the wealthy and for corporations. My problem isn't with any one tax cut or any one spending increase. It's that we keep doing this over and over again. We keep spending more money. We keep cutting more taxes. We don't pay for it. And we don't think about how to use those dollars efficiently. So some money goes to people that really need it. But in the process, we send a lot of money to a lot of people that really don't.
Is this the same? Does this happen also for other countries? Do they find a way to make sure that they balance their budgets, or do they find themselves where we are or close to?
Yeah. So most European countries have some rules that they can't get their borrowing get too far out of hand. So they don't need balanced budgets, but they have rules that prevent them from getting too far out of hand. Most other countries that are wealthy also have, frankly, more functioning political systems, often because it's just a prime minister. There isn't a president and a Congress that are of different parties. And so, yes, other countries absolutely have deficit and debt problems, but they're a lot better at fixing them than we are.
So how do we fix it?
At this point, look, we would need about $7 trillion over the next decade just to keep the debt from not growing fast in the economy. So I'm not talking about paying off the debt. I'm not talking about balancing the budget. I'm just saying having the debt grow at the same pace as the economy, $7 trillion. You can't do that without putting everything on the table. We're going to have to make some reforms to the Medicare program, especially cutting excessive payments we're making to insurance companies, to hospitals for drugs. We're going to have to cap what we spend on defense and non-defense. We're going to have to reform Social Security. We're going to need to raise a lot more tax revenue. At this point, we have to do really a little bit of everything and a lot of some things.
When did we learn that it was 31 that we were at this point? When did we learn that? Who knew first?
I mean, the day before it was 31, it was 30.9 something. So we knew it was coming. We didn't know the exact day because it sort of depends on the trading, but we knew this was coming. This is not a surprise. And I'm less worried. I know 31 trillion is a big number, and so that's what folks are worried about. But what I'm more worried about is if you look at our trajectory, again, as a share of the economy, because bigger economy can afford more debt. As a share of the economy, historically, our debt has been about half. Right now, the debt is as large as the economy, 100%.
Exactly. That's why I feel like we're broke.
Yeah. And that's the problem. It would take a full year of everything we produce to pay our debt right now. And on our current course, it's probably going to be 200% within 25 years. And by the way, based on how politicians act, we're probably going to get there faster.
So the people, right, the Commonwealth, are we the ones that are making the mistakes? I don't think so. I think to get us to $31 trillion in debt, it has to come from some of those that you mentioned, like our military. The Pentagon has so much money to, and we're already engaged in Ukraine and so much more. Where do we start with the big numbers? Where do we need to go and say we need to pull this back? You suggested Medicaid and Medicare. Am I correct?
Medicare. Yeah.
Medicare.
So Medicare is the second largest government program, but it's maybe the best opportunity for efficiencies because so much. Now, I'm not talking about cutting benefits, although we could argue about some changes in the margins. What I'm talking about is where are we paying certain kinds of hospitals too much money? Where are we overpaying private insurance companies? Where can we spend less on drugs? Where can we encourage more care efficiency, encourage people to buy more generic drugs or take order less unnecessary x-rays? So I think there's a lot we can do in Medicare to get more efficiency. And so I would start there. But yes, we're going to need to cut defense. We're going to need to look at Social Security, both the tax side, raising more revenue, and adjustments to benefits. We're going to need to look at everything. The problem is too big to just focus on one part of the budget.
So you really just threw a lot of the seniors under the bus. I mean, seriously,
I mean,
you
I don't agree with that. Again, so on Medicare, the types of changes I'm talking about are actually going to make it a better, more value-based program.
Tell me more.
So let me give you one little example. Right now, Medicare pays more money if you go to a doctor's office that's inside a hospital versus if you go to the exact same appointment at a private doctor. They pay more for the hospital. We should be paying the same. And if we pay the same for Medicare, it's going to save the government money. It's also going to save the seniors money because they'll have less cost sharing. So there's so much we can do to make Medicare more efficient. This isn't about throwing seniors under the bus. It's about making these programs more efficient and actually saving them so they don't go insolvent.
I find it very difficult to because we talk about Medicare and Medicaid, excuse me, so often. I mean, every election that comes up, you know, there are certain things we talk about, taxes, Medicare, education. You know, they're always thrown into the fray, and none of it is ever corrected. It's never corrected. So here we are at $31 trillion, and if we continue, that number continues to go up. We are in desperate need. I mean, we are in big trouble. I don't know if the United States can stay the United States, the way people see us, the way we help others. The United Nations, do we need to start dealing with that? Do we need to start cutting back on the United Nations? How far do we go? How much do we have to do in order to get this down?
Yeah, no, look, I do worry very much about our standing in the world with all of this debt. But money we give to the United Nations or to NATO or things like that, those are we're talking about single-digit billions of dollars, whereas the Medicare program, for example, is almost $1 trillion. So we should look everywhere, but we should really look where the money is and where we can get the efficiencies. And by the way, that also means more taxes. And yes, we talk about this a lot and don't act as much as we should, but we actually just passed a major bill that includes serious reductions to Medicare drug costs. That's going to save money for seniors and save money for the federal government. So we know we can do it. We just did it in the Inflation Reduction Act just a few months ago.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the leadership in this country. We've had so many presidents talk about this, right? We need to pull back on Medicare. We need to do this. We need to do that. Some of the things you've mentioned, we've been talking about for a long time. When will we ever do it? That's the question. Which president that's going to do it?
Look, that's the $31 trillion question, because it's always easier to worry about the next election and not the next generation. And so they've all been kicking the can. Now, maybe with inflation surging so high, with interest rates starting to come up, they're going to see some instant reward to deficit reduction. Usually you don't see it instantly. Usually you see it sort of way in the future. And so maybe there'll be a little more incentive in the next Congress to act. But politicians always like to kick the can if they can.
Why?
Because the things that you need to do to address the debt affect very specific types of people or very specific interest groups, whereas the benefit benefits everybody a little bit. And so it's easier to just say, well, everyone's going to be a little bit worse off than to have to say to a hospital, we're going to cut your payment, or to say to a business, we're going to raise your taxes. And so they don't like to do it. They like to avoid the hard choices, assuming that some future politician will do it. So they can win the next election. We have elections every 2 years in this country. I'm not suggesting we should have less elections, but it changes the attention of our leaders. They're not focused on what's best for the country. They're focused on how do I stay in office.
It's remarkable to me. It's starting to remind me of the story of, my goodness, what is that island about 1,200 miles out or 2,200 miles out from Chile? Gosh, with the big heads on it. Forgive me. What did you say, Jonathan? No, not Galapagos. I'll think of it. But they had a terrible story where they kept feasting off of everything, right? Everything that they had, they used it all the way until they had none left. And that's my concern here for our country. Is it going to get to the point where we have nothing left? And if we have nothing left, what happens?
Well, I don't think it's going to get that bad, because we still have a very vibrant economy. And the truth of the matter is, probably the worst case scenario, I shouldn't say that, probably the bad case scenario is basically what we're experiencing now. So we have, it's very harmful, like this very high inflation. But even this very high inflation, I don't think this spells the end of the country. But it could spell the end of our vibrancy, you know, the end of our leadership in the world, the end of our ability to be the largest, most successful country. So I don't think this is sort of an extinction level event if we don't solve the debt. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't mean it's not troubling. It's very troubling that we're not dealing with this.
It is. And I don't know who is going to step forward, because it's got to be not just a group of people, but there has to be one single person that knows exactly how to deal with this. Who would you suggest that person be?
Well, I don't know. I mean, look, the president of the United States has to take leadership on this issue, and he or she is going to need support of people in both parties. I don't think we can solve this with just Democrats or just Republicans. Just Democrats or just Republicans can make progress, but I think the problem is too big. It's going to take both parties, and it's going to take presidential leadership.
But it's going to take both parties to come together, and that seems impossible today.
It does. It does feel that. Although, you know, we get bits of them coming together. They came together in the infrastructure bill, on the guns bill. So it's not impossible, but it does feel very challenging.
It's very challenging. Money talks. It's the loudest voice we have in this country, money, or the lack thereof. And it just appears that people are suffering, continuing to suffer during this pandemic, and knowing that we don't have any money left, we're going to have to be borrowing. And I don't even know if other countries are willing to borrow, to lend funds to us. Are we still at that point? Do we still have relationships where they will continue to support us when it comes to this type of debt?
Yeah.
Yes?
I mean, to be honest, lending from other countries is barely going up. It's barely covering our new borrowing. Most of our new borrowing is either coming from The American public,
mm-hmm. So,
or the Federal Reserve. And now the Federal Reserve is pulling back. So we're counting, for the most part, on our own citizens and our own companies to keep buying the debt.
Right. And why not, instead of going after Medicare, and trying to pay this down, you know, getting rid of that or pulling back on that, why don't we go to the countries that haven't paid us back, that aren't paying their way through, even at the United I have brain fog a little bit from COVID, but it's frustrating to know that there are other countries that haven't paid their debt to us yet. And if we're not going after that first, then why go after Medicare first?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate with Medicare is the types of changes that we can make to Medicare are ones that are going to make the program cheaper and better, not the ones that are going to be throwing people off the rolls or, dramatically increasing their premiums. We should, again, where there's money to be saved, we should try to save it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the debt that we owe to very low-income countries, the debt we're owed from very low-income countries,
yes,
just isn't large relative to the size of our budget. It's large for those countries, but it's not that large to us. And so we can push for that money harder. But, you know, it's like, your household is spending $20,000 a month more than you're bringing in income. And instead of looking at, your $100,000 car, you're hitting up the guy that owes you $10 because he hasn't paid you back.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you, Mark Goldwine. I wish I had more time with you. You're the Senior VP and Senior Policy Director, Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Wow, Responsible Federal Budget. Let's see where we're going. I'll be paying attention.
Maybe someday.
All right. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
I have to exhale. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope you enjoy the conversation we just had. And I'm curious, to know if you want to text us and let us know what you think about this. You know, here we are at $31 trillion in debt. We don't even have that much money. We don't. So I do see it as us being basically broke. But of course, as you heard our guest saying that, it doesn't work that way. We still have quite a bit to collect from certain ways, and that will be just fine, and that this is happening around the world and that sort of thing. So I'd love for you to send us a text and let us know. We'll see if we can read a couple of those later on tonight. And I'm just curious to know what you thought about that. I know when someone says to me, Medicare is the first thing. Medicare is what we're going to go after. We need to, take that down. Hey, people have been depending on that for so long, and the cost, as he mentioned, the cost in hospitals and that sort of thing, it is astronomical. And, we're just moving towards a big, gigantic accident. Were we going to crash or not? But he made it seem like, no, we won't crash. We'll find a way to get out of this, but it's going to take all of us to get out of this $31 trillion debt. And I don't know how much is being spent that we give to other countries for their protection of their countries, and also them trying to protect us, our allies, that sort of thing. So I'm curious. So I'm going to do some more research because I'm curious about how the whole world responds to a country like ours, who is now at $31 trillion in debt. All right. We had some great presidents that brought us down, man. It really took that number down. But here we are. We never thought we'd get there.
I think what Mr. Goldwine was really stressing is that we really haven't had a balanced budget since Clinton.
Right.
That was the last
time. Almost, though, President Obama did a great job putting money back in.
Right. You know? But I think what he was basically talking about is ever really since September 11th, ever since that time period, there's been money that's been spent on different things, whether it was September 11th, whether it was the war in the Middle East, whether it was the recession of 2008 and 2009, whether it was the COVID pandemic. We've had different things that have come along where we may have not anticipated them as well as we should have, or didn't think it would cost as much to get out of that. Now, you were talking about the war in Ukraine, where we're sending aid to Ukraine, mm-hmm. for that. I don't know if we're ever going to see that money come back.
No, and I don't know if we need to. Here's the thing, Afghanistan and Iran, that was a whole big, gigantic mess. We never should have went.
Yeah.
We never should have been there.
Yeah.
We never should have spent all of those years. What was it, a decade?
Two decades.
It's
20
years. 2 decades. It's so ridiculous. You want to know where the money is? That's where it went. Okay, we got to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you so much for sticking and staying with us right here on WCCO Radio. You're listening to Steel Tonkin. I'm really excited about my next guest because I'm going to ask you this question. Have you ever heard of historical demography? Have you? It's a course of study that Dr. Stephen Ruggles has dedicated his distinguished career to over the past few decades. Now, Dr. Ruggles established the Integrated Public Use Microdata Series, or IPUMS, project in 1991 to dive into the changing demographics that make this nation what it is from the past to today. Now, that work is being recognized with one of the nation's highest academic honors, as Dr. Ruggles has been awarded as a 2022 MacArthur Fellow and will receive one of the famed Genius Grants from that organization. He joins us now on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. Welcome, sir. What a pleasure.
I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Ruggles, how did this come to be? How did you know? What was the moment when you said, this is what we need to know?
Well, I suppose that it was in 1991 when I realized that it was just too hard to try to figure out what has happened in our society over the last 150 years or so. And started working on building this database to try to describe long-run changes, first in the United States and then in other countries.
So if you were to, for those that are listening and they're not quite sure why this is important, give us one sentence that would really help them understand how important this is, because we have all been talking about how our demographics have been changing from day to day, not month to month or year to year or decade to decade, but isn't it really day to day?
Yeah, well, it is day to day, but I look at the long run. I don't look at the short run fluctuations. And it's the long run where you can really see the dramatic changes that are going on. I mean, 150 years ago, we were a society that was essentially an agricultural society where there weren't very many big cities. It wasn't that different from 40,000 years ago. And in the last couple of hundred years, everything has been transformed. We have had industrialization, urbanization, immigration, and a massive demographic transition, a complete shift in the ways families are structured, and all of this is something that has been very hard to even find out what happened. And now we know, thanks to massive new data sets.
So these massive new data sets. Okay, the clear thing for me is that we all know how important demographics really mean, not just to elections and that sort of thing, but to our world, just the whole world. And I'm just wondering, where do we fare here in the United States when it comes to really understanding how important this is? Or are people really looking past it going, yeah, we've heard some of that before? Because this, to me, is seriously important.
Yeah, well, I agree, and you know, this is a golden age we're in terms of historical demography and quantitative social and economic history generally. We've had a data revolution going on in the last decade or so, partly through collaboration with genealogical organizations, where we now have complete information for the United States on everybody who was enumerated between 1790 and 1950. And within the Census Bureau, we've got everybody from 1960 to 2020. And so we really have an extraordinarily granular picture, and we can trace people across their lives and over generations to see how people change over the life course. So we should can look at, for example, geographic and social mobility in the 19th century compared with today. And what we've discovered is that for the first time, we've discovered that instead of economic opportunity opening up over time, the ladder for success has been getting more and more difficult to climb. And also, people aren't moving as much as they used to. Back in the 19th century, most people moved between states over the course of their lives. Now people are much more likely to stay their whole lives in the county they were born in.
It's so true. We have so many Minnesotans who have never crossed over the river to come into Minneapolis from St. Paul. So it's really quite remarkable. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about immigration and its effect on your findings.
Well, immigration is, obviously been a key former of our nation, and we're just now getting up close to the percentage of foreign-born population that we had near the turn of the century, around 1910, when the first massive wave of immigration came along. And so we've been here before, now we're essentially returning to that. But it's extraordinary. And in both periods, we find that the pace of assimilation and economic upward mobility of immigrants is fantastic. The immigrants' kids in particular do better than the native born of native parentage. So it's something that strengthens the country.
So where do you go next? What is your next move when you have accomplished all that you have accomplished and you have so much data to share with the world, not just us here in this country, of how this all works? But what is the next thing for you when it comes to knowing that we are moving, we're not moving as much as we used to? What does that mean to our survival? Are there other things we need to do that you could give us advice about when it comes to moving, trying to figure out where is my place? Where's my place? A lot of Americans, we don't know where our place is just yet. So tell us what's next.
Well, one of the things I'm working on now is trying to figure out what's happening with marriage and cohabitation. You know, over the last 50 years, the marriage rate has gone from the highest in our history to the lowest in our history by far. And now people are marrying at very late ages. And it's not that it's being replaced by cohabitation, because cohabitation is also declining now. And so what we have is more and more young people who are not partnered in any way. And it's unprecedented in history. It's not just in the United States. This is occurring in all of the developed world. I'm trying to figure out what are the drivers of this. I think, there are a bunch of things, and one of them is that the economic opportunity for young people, particularly young men, is a lot lower than it was 40 or 50 years ago.
My goodness, a lot lower?
Yeah. The income of men aged 25 to 29 years old has declined in real terms for the median for the whole population by almost 40%. It's really stunning. I mean, people quote, "Oh, income's higher than it was." Well, that's only because household income is higher, and that's because of the rise of female labor force participation. So now you have two earners. Back in 1960, you would have had one. But the incentives, the marriageability of young men has declined dramatically. So I think that's part of the story, but I don't think it's the whole story. I also think that there's been a big cultural shift.
When you talk about historical data, you know, I've often wondered, do they realize whether or not we were absolutely correct in getting those numbers so that you can do what you do to make sure that we have the information? Because, you know, every time when we didn't have computers and we didn't have ways of doing it like we do today, is that a bad idea? Have we really been good at keeping these numbers close to us, knowing that we know where we've been, where our people have been? Because I know ancestry in our family really means a lot. You know, who went where, when, even back way back to maybe the 1800s even. So I just wonder about that as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, generally speaking, the core source that we have, the historical source that goes way back, is the census. We had the first regularly scheduled census in the world, starting in 1790.
Right.
And generally speaking, the quality of the census has improved over the centuries, but not lately, you know, and the 2020 census was kind of a disaster. You know, it's partly due to, Donald Trump trying to introduce a citizenship question at the last moment. But then we had the pandemic on top of that. And so there's this huge undercount problem in 2020, particularly for minorities and especially for Hispanics. So it's not like things just continuously get better, you know, and it gets harder and harder to take surveys and stuff like that because people don't answer their phones anymore. They screen everything and, it is a difficult situation right now. And it's compounded, in 2020, in the period since 2020 by, the Census Bureau is going nuts about, disclosure control and, injecting random noise into the data that makes it, unreliable as well. We're not in good shape at the moment.
We're not in good shape. So when do you think we will be in better shape?
Well, I'm hoping that the Census Bureau will come to their senses. One of the things we could do is start collecting data from administrative sources because there are a lot of interactions people have with Social Security, IRS, and so on. And Census Bureau has been pretty hands-off in the past and not used these sources. But, you know, we might have to because we do need the data. We need to know what's going on.
We do need to know what's going on. But of course, sir, as you already know, just collecting data, you can say that to different groups of people from all over the world. And many of us are just terrified of it because we don't know how much data is being collected. Some tell us that, no, you'll know and we'll only go so far. But we go further and further and further.
Yeah, well, we haven't. The government has not. The government doesn't have a very well integrated data at all. The private sector, all the companies that are collecting data about us, but
right.
Of course people click and sign off on that. People are happy to give up all their information to Facebook or to the bank or to all these people that sell the data then, and I kind of think that if there's a threat to privacy, it's much more the private sector than it is the government.
Dr. Stephen Ruggles, I am so thankful that you joined us tonight, Professor of History and Population Studies at the University of Minnesota. You are so incredible, and I really look forward to more of your work. I hope that I can have you on again sometime. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care, sir.
Bye-bye.
Oh, my goodness. Boy, you hear about historical demography, and you just kind of go, really? Oh, my goodness. It is quite remarkable. He is a remarkable man. He is certified genius, And he is at the University of Minnesota. It's just remarkable. We are so fortunate here in this great state of Minnesota. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. My goodness, I am still thinking about the conversation we just had with a genius. My goodness, I get nervous sometimes. The man I was married to for 20 years actually tested on the cusp of genius. And so living with someone that brilliant, that bright, really kind of opened my eyes to other types of things to read, other ways to look at the world. And it was quite remarkable tonight. It was the University of Minnesota professor awarded MacArthur Fellowship, and of course you heard his name several times, Dr. Stephen Ruggles, Regents Professor of History and Population Studies and Director of the Institute for Social Research and Data Innovation at the University of Minnesota. He has been honored by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation as one of this year's MacArthur Fellows, commonly known as the Genius Grant, by the way. The fellowship is regarded as one of the nation's most prestigious awards for intellectual and artistic achievement. Really quite remarkable man. You know, when you're sitting among a genius, it's startling. It is absolutely startling. Have you ever sat with a genius before, Jonathan?
What are you talking about?
Okay, then.
What are you talking?
You are the genius.
Yes. Just think of my business. The old business card from the Looney Tunes. Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
See, yeah, no. Anyway, it was remarkable. I would love to know more about this IPUM, IPUM.
IPUMs. It's called IPUMs.
Oh, they call it IPUM.
IPUMs.
Oh, IPUMs.
Yes. Yep, that's how the acronym is said. IPUM.
That's
how
why I wouldn't say it. I wouldn't say IPUM.
Yeah, yeah,
I was
yeah.
like, man, I don't know if that's right. But
yes,
yeah, IPUMs.
It is said IPUMs.
How about that? It was just wonderful, really. All right, you guys, coming up next, of course, is Center Stage. All things arts and entertainment, we just believe you ought to know about it. And, of course, we've got some guests. There was one that we weren't able to touch base with last Sunday, but we are definitely going to go there this Sunday, tonight. So stay tuned. We've got some really great guests for that hour. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you so much for sticking and staying with us right here on WCCO Radio. You're listening to Steel Tonkin. I'm really excited about my next guest because I'm going to ask you this question. Have you ever heard of historical demography? Have you? It's a course of study that Dr. Stephen Ruggles has dedicated his distinguished career to over the past few decades. Now, Dr. Ruggles established the Integrated Public Use Microdata Series, or IPUMS, project in 1991 to dive into the changing demographics that make this nation what it is from the past to today. Now, that work is being recognized with one of the nation's highest academic honors, as Dr. Ruggles has been awarded as a 2022 MacArthur Fellow and will receive one of the famed Genius Grants from that organization. He joins us now on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. Welcome, sir. What a pleasure.
I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Ruggles, how did this come to be? How did you know? What was the moment when you said, this is what we need to know?
Well, I suppose that it was in 1991 when I realized that it was just too hard to try to figure out what has happened in our society over the last 150 years or so. And started working on building this database to try to describe long-run changes, first in the United States and then in other countries.
So if you were to, for those that are listening and they're not quite sure why this is important, give us one sentence that would really help them understand how important this is, because we have all been talking about how our demographics have been changing from day to day, not month to month or year to year or decade to decade, but isn't it really day to day?
Yeah, well, it is day to day, but I look at the long run. I don't look at the short-run fluctuations. And it's the long run where you can really see the dramatic changes that are going on. I mean, 150 years ago, we were a society that was essentially an agricultural society where there weren't very many big cities. It wasn't that different from 40,000 years ago. And in the last couple of hundred years, everything has been transformed. We have had industrialization, urbanization, immigration, and a massive demographic transition, a complete shift in the ways families are structured. And all of this is something that has been very hard to even find out what happened. And now we know, thanks to massive new data sets.
So these massive new data sets, okay, the clear thing for me is that we all know how important demographics really mean, not just to elections and that sort of thing, but to our world, just the whole world. And I'm just wondering, where do we fare here in the United States when it comes to really understanding how important this is? Or are people really looking past it going, yeah, we've heard some of that before? Because this, to me, is seriously important.
Yeah, well, I agree, and you know, this is a golden age we're in terms of historical demography and quantitative social and economic history generally. We've had a data revolution going on in the last decade or so, partly through collaboration with genealogical organizations, where we now have complete information for the United States on everybody who was enumerated between 1790 and 1950. And within the Census Bureau, we've got everybody from 1960 to 2020. And so we really have an extraordinarily granular picture, and we can trace people across their lives and over generations to see how people change over the life course. So we can look at, for example, geographic and social mobility in the 19th century compared with today. And what we've discovered is that for the first time, we've discovered that instead of economic opportunity opening up over time, the ladder for success has been getting more and more difficult to climb. And also, people aren't moving as much as they used to. Back in the 19th century, most people moved between states over the course of their lives. Now people are much more likely to stay their whole lives in the county they were born in.
It's so true. We have so many Minnesotans who have never crossed over the river to come into Minneapolis from St. Paul. So it's really quite remarkable. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about immigration and its effect on your findings.
Well, immigration is, obviously been a key former of our nation, and we're just now getting up close to the percentage of foreign-born population that we had near the turn of the century, around 1910, when the first massive wave of immigration came along, and so we've been here before, now we're essentially returning to that. But it's extraordinary, and in both periods, we find that the pace of assimilation and economic upward mobility of immigrants is fantastic. And the immigrants' kids, in particular, do better than the native-born of native parentage. So it's something that strengthens the country.
So where do you go next? What is your next move when you have accomplished all that you have accomplished and you have so much data to share with the world, not just us here in this country, of how this all works? But what is the next thing for you when it comes to knowing that we are moving, we're not moving as much as we used to? What does that mean to our survival? Are there other things we need to do that you could give us advice about when it comes to moving, trying to figure out where is my place? where's my place? A lot of Americans, we don't know where our place is just yet. So tell us what's next.
Well, one of the things I'm working on now is trying to figure out what's happening with marriage and cohabitation. You know, over the last 50 years, the marriage rate has gone from the highest in our history to the lowest in our history by far. And now people are marrying at very late ages. And you know, it's not that it's being replaced by cohabitation, because cohabitation is also declining now. And so what we have is more and more young people who are not partnered in any way. And it's unprecedented in history. It's not just in the United States. This is occurring in all of the developed world. I'm trying to figure out what are the drivers of this. I think, you know, and there are a bunch of things, and one of them is that the economic opportunity for young people, particularly young men, is a lot lower than it was 40 or 50 years ago.
My goodness. A lot lower?
Yeah. Yeah. The income of men aged 25 to 29 years old has declined in real terms, for the median for the whole population, by almost 40%. It's really stunning. I mean, people quote, oh, income's higher than it was. Well, that's only because household income is higher, and that's because of the rise of female labor force participation. So now you have two earners. Back in 1960, you would have had one. But the incentives, the marriageability of young men has declined dramatically. So I think that's part of the story, but I don't think it's the whole story. I also think that there's been a big cultural shift.
When you talk about historical data, you know, I've often wondered, do they realize whether or not we were absolutely correct in getting those numbers so that you can do what you do to make sure that we have the information? Because, you know, every time when we didn't have computers and we didn't have ways of doing it like we do today, is that a bad idea? Have we really been good at keeping these numbers close to us, knowing that we know where we've been, where our people have been? Because I know ancestry in our family really means a lot. You know, who went where, when, even back way back to maybe the 1800s even. So I just wonder about that as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, generally speaking, the core source that we have, the historical source that goes way back, is the census. We had the first regularly scheduled census in the world, starting in 1790.
Right.
And generally speaking, the quality of the census has improved over the centuries, but not lately, you know, and the 2020 census was kind of a disaster. It's partly due to, Donald Trump trying to introduce a citizenship question at the last moment. But then we had the pandemic on top of that, and so there's this huge undercount problem in 2020, particularly for minorities and especially for Hispanics. So it's not like things just continuously get better, you know, and it gets harder and harder to take surveys and stuff like that because people don't answer their phones anymore. They screen everything, and it is a difficult situation right now, and it's compounded in 2020 in the period since 2020 by the Census Bureau is going nuts about disclosure control and injecting random noise into the data that makes it unreliable as well. We're not in good shape at the moment.
We're not in good shape. So when do you think we will be in better shape?
Well, I'm hoping that the Census Bureau will come to their senses. One of the things we could do is start collecting data from administrative sources, because there are a lot of interactions people have with Social Security, IRS, and so on. And Census Bureau has been pretty hands-off in the past and not used these sources. But, you know, we might have to because we do need the data. We need to know what's going on.
We do need to know what's going on. But, of course, sir, as you already know, just collecting data, you can say that to different groups of people from all over the world, and many of us are just terrified of it because we don't know how much data is being collected. Some tell us that, no, you'll know, and we'll only go so far, but we go further and further and further.
Yeah, well, I mean, we haven't. And, I mean, the government has not. The government doesn't have a very well integrated data at all. The private sector, all the companies that are collecting data about us, but
right.
Of course people click and sign off on that. People are happy to give up all their information to Facebook or to the bank or to all these people that sell the data then, and I kind of think that if there's a threat to privacy, it's much more the private sector than it is the government.
Dr. Stephen Ruggles, I am so thankful that you joined us tonight, professor of history and population studies at the University of Minnesota. You are so incredible, and I really look forward to more of your work. I hope that I can have you on again sometime. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care, sir.
Bye-bye.
Oh, my goodness. Boy, you hear about historical demography, and you just kind of go, really? Oh, my goodness. It is quite remarkable. He is a remarkable man. He is certified genius, and he is at the University of Minnesota. It's just remarkable. We are so fortunate here in this great state of Minnesota. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. My goodness, I am still thinking about the conversation we just had with the genius. My goodness, I get nervous sometimes. The man I was married to for 20 years actually tested on the cusp of genius. And so living with someone that brilliant, that bright, really kind of opened my eyes to other types of things to read, other ways to look at the world. And it was quite remarkable tonight. It was the University of Minnesota professor awarded MacArthur Fellowship. And of course, you heard his name several times, Dr. Stephen Ruggles, Regents Professor of History and Population Studies and Director of the Institute for Social Research and Data Innovation at the University of Minnesota. He has been honored by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation as one of this year's MacArthur Fellows, commonly known as the Genius Grant, by the way. The fellowship is regarded as one of the nation's most prestigious awards for intellectual and artistic achievement. Really quite remarkable man. When you're sitting among a genius, it's startling. It is absolutely startling. Have you ever sat with a genius before, Jonathan?
What are you talking about?
Okay, then.
What are you talking?
You are the genius?
Yes. Just think of my business, the old business card from the Looney Tunes. Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
See, yeah, no. Anyway, it was remarkable. I would love to know more about this IPUM, IPUM.
IPUMS. It's called IPUMS.
Oh, they call it IPUM.
IPUMS.
Oh, IPUMS.
Yes. Yep, that's how the acronym is said. IPUM. That's how
why
says
I wouldn't
it.
Say it. I wouldn't say IPUMS.
Yeah, yeah,
I was
yeah.
like, man, I don't know if that's right. But
yes,
yeah,
IPUMS. It is said IPUMS.
How about that? It was just wonderful, really. All right, you guys, coming up next, of course, is Center Stage. All things arts and entertainment, we just believe you ought to know about it. And, of course, we've got some guests. There was one that we weren't able to touch base with last Sunday, but we are definitely going to go there this Sunday, tonight. So stay tuned. We've got some really great guests for that hour. And then the Mom and Michael Hour, I want to let you know that Michael cannot join us tonight, but he will be back next Sunday. Finally, he's been on vacation, and finally at Amazon, you don't get to do that much. So yeah, he's going to join us next Sunday. But tonight, Jonathan and I will have a good time. And anytime you want to join us, you know you can, right? All you have to do is dial 461 or text 461. I don't have that right. 651-461-9226. Let me say that again. 651-461-9226. All right, we'll be back. My goodness, I am still thinking about the conversation we just had with the genius. My goodness, I get nervous sometimes. The man I was married to for 20 years actually tested on the cusp of genius. And so living with someone that brilliant, that bright, really kind of opened my eyes to other types of things to read, other ways to look at the world. And it was quite remarkable tonight. It was the University of Minnesota professor awarded MacArthur Fellowship. And of course, you heard his name several times, Dr. Stephen Ruggles, Regents Professor of History and Population Studies and Director of the Institute for Social Research and Data Innovation at the University of Minnesota. He has been honored by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation as one of this year's MacArthur Fellows, commonly known as the Genius Grant, by the way. The fellowship is regarded as one of the nation's most prestigious awards for intellectual and artistic achievement. Really quite remarkable, man. You know, when you're sitting among a genius, it's startling. It is absolutely startling. Have you ever sat with a genius before, Jonathan?
What are you talking about?
Okay, then.
What are you talking?
You are the genius?
Yes. Just think of my business, the old business card from the Looney Tunes. Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
See, yeah, no. Anyway, it was remarkable. I would love to know more about this IPUM, IPUM.
IPUM. It's called IPUM.
Oh, they call it IPUM.
IPUMs.
Oh, IPUMs.
Yes. Yep, that's how the acronym is said. IPUM. That's how
why I wouldn't say it. I wouldn't say IPUMs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, man, I don't know if that's right. But
yes,
yeah, IPUMs.
It is said IPUMs.
How about that? It was just wonderful, really. All right, you guys, coming up next, of course, is Center Stage. All things arts and entertainment. We just believe you ought to know about it. And of course, we've got some guests. There was one that we weren't able to touch base with last Sunday, but we are definitely going to go there this Sunday, tonight. So stay tuned. We've got some really great guests for that hour. And then the Mom and Michael Hour, I want to let you know that Michael cannot join us tonight, but he will be back next Sunday. Finally, he's been on vacation, finally, at Amazon. You don't get to do that much. So yeah, he's going to join us next Sunday. But tonight, Jonathan and I will have a good time. And anytime you want to join us, you know you can, right? All you have to do is dial 461 or text 461. I don't have that right. 651-461-9226. Let me say that again. 651-461-9226. All right, we'll be back.